Welcome to Eastern Standard. Thanks for joining us for episode 18 of our special quarterly series, Democracy Optimist. It's hosted by Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law. Democracy Optimist is produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU.
What does it mean? To be American.
Since the November election and President Trump's inauguration on January 20th, we've seen the new administration roll out many executive orders that test the limits of law and American democracy itself. And it's been challenging to absorb and process this constant, almost daily flow of often controversial actions. This is happening even as some are already working on the midterm elections of 2026. The continued function of American elections and an understanding of voting rights is the current focus of this series. Here's Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. It's early 2025, but plans are already underway for the 2026 midterm elections and the 2028 presidential election. I'm not talking about candidates padding their war chests or campaign operatives figuring out the best messaging. I'm talking about the plans for actually running the election. I've said it many times. There's never an off year for elections. That's especially true if you work at the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. I'm guessing most people have never even heard of the Election Assistance Commission, or EAC. It's a crucial federal agency that helps to make our election system fair and secure. And its work never stops. Here to discuss the inner workings of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission is Ben Hovland, who is one of the four commissioners on the EAC and is currently serving as its chair. Ben, welcome to Democracy Optimist. So first, tell us what the EAC is. I know its history actually goes back to Bush v. Gore in 2000 and the Help America Vote Act in 2002, a federal law that created the agency. Fill us in on some of that history.
Well, thanks for that. And you're exactly right. We are not a household name for most people, but you're right. We were created by the Help America Vote Act, which was Congress's response to the Florida 2000 election, essentially. And we were created to be an independent bipartisan agency. And we were given four primary mission areas. First, we test and certify voting equipment. We give out federal grant money to the states. We also conduct something called the Election Administration and Voting Survey, or EAVES, which is the only national survey of its kind that looks at how Americans are engaging in the process, how they're participating. And by that, I mean how they're getting registered to vote. Is it that at a motor vehicle office? Is that online? Is that through a third-party group? How they're voting? Is that mail? Is that early in person? Is that on election day? We even see what the average age of poll workers are out of that study. And so it's very valuable for data-driven decisions and for policymakers. And then finally, Congress charged us with being a clearinghouse of best practices. With each state running elections a little differently, we were basically asked to look across the states, take that national perspective, and identify those things that can be helpful for other states or other jurisdictions to better serve their voters.
So it sounds like the work was really crucial in 2020 when we had the pandemic election. And then, of course, we had the 2024 election as well, both with higher turnout historically than we've seen in previous elections. Tell us a little bit about the work of the EAC in supporting election administrators and supporting states in running those two past presidential elections in particular.
It has been an interesting time to be an election administration, to say the least.
interesting time to study it as well.
2020, again, an election like we'd never seen, with the global pandemic taking place, with people having, with election administrators having to shift how they were going to administer elections. So a couple things that really stick out in my mind about that election. First, the EAC distributed $825 million in grants to the states. Some of that was HAVA security grants, and some of that was CARES Act funding to help specifically around the pandemic, but again, allowed people to make sure that poll workers were safe, that election officials were safe, you know, get things like PPE, but also adjust some of the processes. Again, we knew with the pandemic, more people would be voting by mail than ever before, and that turned out to be true. Similarly, we were able to really lean into that clearinghouse function. I was looking at it, you know, time has flown, but looking back on it, I was able to record a video with three election officials who had been in mail-driven states but had been there through that transition. People who had started as, you know, running basically a traditional polling place model, but moved to a vote-by-mail model. And they were able to share tips, you know, very pragmatic tips about what that transition looked like, lessons learned from that, and give examples of ways that things that would help their colleagues around the country who now were going to do this in a matter of months compared to the years that those folks had to do the transition. And so that was a really big deal to be able to share those best practices across the country, really take advantage of federalism in that case and share and use those differences to our advantage. And finally, you know, while more Americans than ever voted by mail, a lot of Americans still wanted to vote in person, and it was important to have that option. But to do that, you need poll workers. And, you know, we saw in some of the early primary states right after sort of the shutdown for the pandemic, you know, massive shortages of poll workers, and it was a big deal. So we launched something called National Poll Worker Recruitment Day, and really, you know, helped to recruit a new generation of poll workers, educate people about this need for people to be a poll worker, let people know that this was a way they could serve their communities. And so those are a few that really stick out from 2020. And of course, you know, the time between 2020 and 24, we saw a whole new threat landscape and challenges for the elections community. And so the EAC had to adapt to that. You know, some of the things that we've been working on in the last couple of years are really to support people for the 2024 election. We're looking at communications resources and tools. You know, whenever you're doing things at the 50 state level or the national level, you know, it's really hard to do a one size fits all. So we've really focused on things like toolkits or templates that can be customizable. So we can do some of that work, recognizing that so many local offices, you know, maybe don't have a dedicated communication staff or don't have, you know, the ability to do some of that graphic design work. And we can have a customizable template that then they can put in the information on their website or how to get to, you know, where you get registered or what the registration deadline is or other important information for voters to have and really help with that trusted source communications effort. But we also, you know, have seen a significant turnover. So we did more with training than we've ever done before and also recognized that there are things that are really critical to do sort of no matter what, like continuity of operations planning and providing templates and guidance around that. And we certainly saw that pay dividends in a year that had major weather impacts, whether that was the hurricanes, we saw flooding, we saw tornadoes, we saw a lot of weather all over the country. And so again, we continue to think through ways to provide those resources to support election officials as they run elections.
So what are you doing in a so-called off year now as we get moving to 2026 in the midterms and the 2028 elections? I saw that you kind of laughed when I said off year because, right, there is no off year from your perspective.
That's exactly right. I mean, there is no off year. You know, so many, you know, that's such a misconception that people have about elections is that, you know, oh, well, what do you do the other 364 days a year or things of that nature? And, you know, the reality is election administration is a year-round job. The difference is in those so-called off years, that's certainly when election administrators have more time, if you will, to implement new programs, to think about new programs. So I mentioned the clearinghouse resources that the EAC provides. You know, this is that moment where people really might be looking at those or thinking about implementing those. So certainly we're supportive in that area. But also there are things, I mentioned our testing and certification requirements. We created a new standard a couple years ago called the voluntary, or it's the overall standard is the Voluntary Voting System Guidelines, which is a mouthful. Well, we did a new standard of that in 2020, but this year we'll see the first equipment certified to that standard. So we'll see a new generation of voting equipment starting to emerge, which is great. You know, there's advanced requirements on that around security, accessibility, usability. Again, really a leap forward, which we're excited to see that sort of come out. And so we'll be talking about that. We're very close to certifying the first electronic poll book that the agency's ever certified in a new program that we created around election supporting technology. So there's a lot going on, even in a so-called off year.
So all of this discussion is part of this idea in the way in which we run elections, in that there's not a federal agency that actually administers the election. Your agency, the EAC, helps states run elections. I often say that, you know, we don't really have one election day. We have 51, or include the territories, 50 some odd election days that all happen at the same time. And actually, we have thousands of election days that all happen at the same time, because local jurisdictions are really the ones on the ground that run elections. And your agency is there to facilitate, right? So do you think this is a good model? I mean, should we have an agency like yours that actually administers the election, or does it work to have a federal agency that is, you know, just sort of facilitating and helping the states in their work?
So over the course of my career, I've probably done, you know, several 180s on this, and I've worn different hats and been in different roles, whether it was at the Missouri Secretary of State's office or the U.S. Senate, you know, and I've thought about this in a lot of different ways. But I think where I've really come to, and certainly the EAC, in my opinion, reflects this, is to embrace that federalism. It is what we have, you know, certainly with the federal government, and I think there's a place for federal floors, and we've seen that over the years. But they're really, you know, if you embrace the federalism, if you embrace those differences, there really are a lot of benefits. You know, I mentioned what we saw during the pandemic and how we were able to learn and utilize some of the lessons learned from the vote by mail states. But there's so many areas like that, and really, again, that's what the clearinghouse function of the agency was designed to be. We are a largely non-regulatory agency. I say that we're a customer service agency. And so much of that is thinking through, you know, how can you serve election officials? How can you make their job better? How can you provide something that is useful to them to ultimately better serve their voters? And when we look out across the states, you know, there are all these real world experiments happening where we can see what the impact is or how people engage in these processes. And in our states and our communities, you know, often have different histories and different cultures. And, you know, we see in the West, you know, we certainly have seen people lean into to vote by mail more with broader geographies and, you know, some of the distances that, you know, where you have counties that are bigger than entire states. That might be pragmatically the best way for them. And then certainly, you know, we have some of the more traditional models in the Northeast, and you have some states that are, you know, sticking with mostly election day voting. And then you have people who have really embraced things like early voting and vote centers. And so to be able to see that, to be able to track that, to be able to talk about that and the options, I think is a big deal to, again, provide options for policymakers to see how there are real world impacts for the voter experience with that.
So let's talk about the actual commissioners on the Election Assistance Commission and the way the agency is set up. You've got four commissioners, two Democrats, two Republicans. In a world where everything seems so polarized, that sounds like a recipe for gridlock and failure. How does it actually work in operation to have, you know, the two and two of Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, certainly, you know, particularly in Washington, obviously, when you've got two and two, you know, when you're in a bipartisan situation, that does seem like a recipe to not get things done. But, you know, I think we've done a great job working together. I think we really focus on this concept that, you know, good election administration is about good governance and customer service. And you see election administrators around the country with that attitude. I can't tell you how many election officials that I visited their offices, I've toured, I've talked to their staff, and I have no idea what party they are. And they may be elected officials and run on a partisan office, but their attitude toward their voters and how they serve their voters is in a nonpartisan way. And I think we've done a good job of focusing on that approach in my tenure. And I think that when you do that, there's a lot of common ground. You know, I remember when so we're often paired up and passed through the Senate. And so Commissioner Palmer and I went through the Senate together through that process. And one of our first meetings once we were on the commission was with the National Association of Secretaries of State. And a secretary asked, you know, basically the question you asked of, you know, how are you not going to get bogged down in partisanship? And I said, well, you know, I think we'll do all the stuff that we agree on first, and then we'll take care of the other stuff. And the reality is, you know, there really is enough common ground that we haven't gotten to that other stuff yet. And that has, I think, served the agency well and ultimately election officials and the voters.
Yeah, and what you said echoes what I hear from local election officials all the time. I mean, you know, as an election law professor, I think it's crazy that the U.S. is the only modern democracy where partisan elected officials run our elections, and yet virtually all of them basically take their partisan hat off when it comes to the actual administration. Of course, you're always going to have stories of things you hear about, but these are dedicated public servants. And I think what you're saying is that we need to trust them. We need way more trust in our elections as a general matter. And your message seems to be that we can trust the people who are running our election system. And election trust gets me to another question, which is about turnout. So in 2024 nationwide, we had about 63% turnout for the presidential election. And I remember the next day after the election in November, there was these news stories about this massive turnout, and it was so strong and the second highest ever, second only to 2020. Is two-thirds or under two-thirds turnout acceptable? And of course, it's not even talking about primaries and midterm elections, et cetera, which is a lot lower. Well, what are your thoughts on the turnout question?
You know, I think that that's a really good question. It's certainly something that I've thought about a lot over the years. And what it really ends up boiling down to me, you know, turnout is a complicated thing, as you know. There's a lot of factors on that. A lot of that has to do with candidates and politics. And, you know, so there's that side of the House. For what I view as the election administrative side of the House, you know, where I focus, to me, again, back to that good governance customer service mantra, you know, if we provide the opportunity to vote, if you reduce the barriers or reasons that people can't participate, if Americans choose not to, that's also their right. You know, we're not a compulsory voting country. You know, Americans have that right to not to participate. I want them to. I clearly believe in it and think that people should. But what I'm concerned about is people who do vote having a good experience, people having the opportunity to vote if they want to, and there not being hurdles or barriers that keep them from participating if they want to vote.
So are you optimistic about elections? You know, this is a show that's called Democracy Optimist in 2025. What's your take on that?
Yeah, and I certainly, you know, I love the title and I'm glad about optimism. I know that can be a challenge at times. And again, you know, this is a space that very much gets muddled with politics. And I do think it's important for people to understand the distinction. I use this metaphor. I think a lot of times when people cover election administrations, the same reporters that cover politics. And so it sometimes looks like a horse race, or they try to make it seem like a horse race. And to me, election administration is the track. And then you got to make sure it's taken care of and it's smooth and people can run that fair race. And ultimately, I think that I am an optimist about that. And I think when you look at the ways that we've improved election administration in the last handful of years, again, that good governance, customer service idea that I keep coming back to, we've seen an expansion of voting options. You know, you see more no excuse absentee or mail ballots. You see things like vote centers and early voting. We're finding more ways to engage people or give them the opportunity to participate in a way that works for them. And so much of that didn't exist just a few years ago. So while there are challenges, while there are difficulties, I think we've seen a lot of progress. And I am hopeful for our democracy and election administration broadly.
Ben Hovland is the chair of the U.S. Election Assistance Commission. Ben, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me. Great to join you.
Josh, you say it all the time that every vote matters, and sometimes it can matter to the point of deciding an election. So if you would tell us about what happened in Corpus Christi, Texas earlier this year.
Yeah, you just never know when your vote could be the one that decides a close election, especially in a local race. Corpus Christi voted for a city council seat in November 2024. None of the five candidates received a majority, so the election went to a runoff in December. That runoff ended in a tie. Each candidate received exactly 1,916 votes. A recount confirmed the tie. So election officials had to figure out what to do. State law says that to resolve a tie, officials should determine the winner through a game of chance. Local officials in Corpus Christi can decide which game of chance made the most sense for them. They actually spent 3 days in meetings trying to decide the best way to do it. As reported by VoteBeat, some members of the public were quite perplexed. VoteBeat quoted one local resident as saying, "What's next, a giant rock, paper, scissors tournament to find out who will be the next mayor?" After the 3 days of meetings, Corpus Christi officials decided to have the candidates each draw one of 10 small numbered beads from a box. The candidate who drew the bead with the higher number would be declared the winner. To determine the order of drawing the beads, the candidates rolled the die on the table at the same time. The higher number went first. Then they drew the beads. One candidate drew a bead with a 2 on it. The other one had a 3 and was declared the winner. Perhaps it's unorthodox, but when the result is a tie, a game of chance is perhaps better than the alternative, spending the time and money to run another election. But if one additional person had voted in Corpus Christi, Texas, then one of the candidates actually would have had a majority.
A lot has happened since President Trump took office on January 20th, to say the least. And whether one supports him or doesn't, it's undeniable that he has worked pretty quickly to change the way federal government runs. How should those who declare themselves to be a democracy optimist respond to this?
Yeah, it is hard to keep up with the news, and you're correct that a lot has changed already. Elections have consequences, of course, and the courts are already issuing rulings on some of Trump's decisions. But none of this negates the power of bipartisan local reforms and the power of stronger civics education and an engaged citizenry. We just need to double down in our efforts to strengthen our democratic processes, and that can start at the local level. We also have to have a conversation about changing the way we approach civics education. So my advice is not to throw up your hands and do nothing, whether you like what's happening or not. Being a democracy optimist is about hope for the future. Hope can spur action, and you can start that work in your local community.
Well, one of the themes in this series is that voters themselves can help to support democracy, and that includes getting accurate information about the voting process. What's one thing people can do to arm themselves with reliable information about our elections?
Our guest, Ben Hovland, mentioned the publication that the EAC publishes every 2 years. It's a comprehensive guide to the previous election called the Election Administration and Voting Survey, or EAVES. The EAC compiles data from all 50 states, D.C., and five U.S. territories about the ways Americans voted and how these jurisdictions administer their elections. The guides are chock full of interesting information about voter turnout, methods of voting, military and overseas voters, and more. And the data is sometimes broken down to the county level. It's a great tool for anyone who is interested in learning more about how our elections actually work, coming from a reliable, nonpartisan source and written in an accessible way. Check it out at eac.gov and click on Research.
Coming up in a moment.
I think we were all very apprehensive about 2024, right? Some people even said that by the end of that year, we wouldn't know if democracy will survive or not. And it was not black and white. We saw a bit of everything last year.
Dr. Fernanda Barril, Deputy Director of the Center for Applied Research and Learning at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special series from Eastern Standard and WEKU.
The WEKU app is redesigned and totally updated. We've made it easier to play the live streams of WEKU and WEKU Classical. You can also find WEKU podcasts and NPR podcasts all in one place. There's more information on what's playing on WEKU Classical. The updated WEKU app is available in the Apple App Store and on Google Play.
The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
I'm Tom Martin, and we're back with Democracy Optimist, an extension of our 2024 election series, now offered quarterly from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor, Josh Douglas.
2024 gave us an election like no other. It was contentious and hard fought. Our show, Democracy Optimist, examined numerous aspects of the election system, from redistricting to misinformation to the actual process of casting your ballot. I remain a democracy optimist after the 2024 election because the process was fair, transparent, and resulted in the people choosing the leaders they wanted. Now it's 2025, an off year for elections in the U.S. But the work of election administration and preparation never stops. Indeed, it is perhaps even more important for us all to pay attention to the election system when the glare of scrutiny is off, as the election policies adopted in 2025 will impact the 2026 midterm elections and the next presidential election. There's never an off year for voting rights. That's true both in the United States and abroad. 2024 saw elections in nearly 80 countries worldwide, with around 1 billion people casting ballots. 2025 will also feature many important elections that will impact democracy, including in Canada, Germany, and beyond. Here to offer an international perspective on elections and democracy is Dr. Fernanda Barril, the Deputy Director of the Center for Applied Research and Learning at the International Foundation for Electoral Systems. She's an expert on sustaining democracy. Fernanda, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you for having me.
So first, can you tell us a little bit about your organization, the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES, its acronym? What is it and how does it help to sustain democracy throughout the world?
Of course, yes. So IFES is a nonprofit and nonpartisan organization, and we work to strengthen electoral processes, governance, and democracy more broadly around the world. And we did this both through research and technical assistance directly. We currently have offices in 39 countries, but we've worked in more than 145 countries in almost 40 years of history now. In last year alone, we supported 28 national elections. So we work with election commissions, other public institutions, civil society, and our programs vary a lot depending on needs of partners in emerging threats. So our scope really changes, evolves, and expands all the time.
That's very fascinating because I think sometimes we have such a U.S.-centric thought process when it comes to elections and democracy, and yet you have elections and democracy all over the world as your organization is helping to facilitate the way we think about that. So tell us, why should we care here in the U.S. about how other countries approach democracy? You know, we're so different. We've got the Electoral College to select the president. We're generally thought of as the world's leader. So shouldn't they be looking at us as opposed to us so much looking at what other countries are doing?
Yeah, I think there are many reasons for the U.S. to care. And I can share at least two perspectives. One is why Americans should care about other countries becoming or remaining democratic, right? And it's not just about morals and maintaining the commitment to human rights and democratic values, but also democracies are less likely to go to war against each other. They are more reliable partners. They are more effective at dealing with catastrophes, for example. They can directly affect national security. But I think to answer your question more directly, why we should care about democratic processes themselves, right, in other countries, why Americans should care about how they conduct elections or prevent or address irregularities or deal with election complaints, for example. I think it's obvious by now that the threats to democracy are global, right? They're happening everywhere and also originating in the most different places. So we can apply lessons learned from other countries to both prevent similar problems here and to inform solutions. So, for example, with the recent case of voter data breach in the UK, which the British government attributed to China, what kind of vulnerabilities did the malign foreign actors leverage, right? Do we have these vulnerabilities ourselves here? How can we patch them and protect the systems? So I think of comparative knowledge and lessons learned as very valuable shortcuts because we get the benefit of hindsight without necessarily having to experience the problem.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And of course, while we're learning from other countries are also learning or at least observing us. In November last year, your organization, IFAS, brought hundreds of election officials from all over the world to observe the U.S. election. I was there the day before. I spoke on a panel where they had basically a whole day's worth of education about the U.S. election system. And then these election officials from other countries actually visited polling places in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. to watch the election. What did they learn? What do you think the big takeaway was for others who observe our elections, from others from other countries who observe our elections?
Well, first of all, thank you again for participating in our panel, Josh. It was very interesting. And the event itself is very unique, right? We bring so many election commissioners, authorities from everywhere to learn about the process and to share their own experiences as well. I think one issue that many visitors were shocked about was to see how different the processes were just a few miles away, right? So they went to different polling stations, as you mentioned. They saw different ballots, also different machines from different vendors, different security provisions, even for the polling station. And in most countries where IFAS works, the election process is much more centralized and standardized. We usually have national election management bodies with some regional or local branches, but very different from the U.S. The other thing that they were very surprised about was that more than half of Americans had already cast their ballots right before the official election day. And so, there were certainly lessons learned about coordination, logistics, and this expanded enfranchisement, especially through the remote voting methods that they took back home.
Yeah, that's interesting that a lot of other countries, most other countries don't have the same kind of early voting opportunities and culture that has now sprung up about voting. And then the point on decentralization is interesting as well. You know, some people say that the fact of our election system in the U.S. being so decentralized is a good thing because places can try different strategies, try different methods of voting and see what works best. If you had, you know, one rule nationwide, maybe it'd be a bad rule. On the other hand, it is a little strange compared to other countries in not having a national election policy in terms of how the process works. So do you have a sense of what other people, you know, they said they were, you said they were surprised about how decentralized it was. Did they think it was a bad thing? I know that's generalizing a large group of people, but did you have any sense of whether they thought this was a good system or a bad system?
Unfortunately, I can tell that the general sense was that was more negative because they are election authorities, right? Mainly most of those visitors. So they already face those challenges in communicating internally within the organizations when it's a much smaller, more centralized institution. So just the thought of having to coordinate across so many counties all around such a big country, it was really scary for them. So they were just shocked that it works in the first place.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So let's talk about other countries now and what's going to happen in 2025. So around 70 countries, give or take, we're still trying to figure out if, you know, certain countries will actually have elections. But around 70 will have national elections in 2025. Some of these elections will occur amid a lot of instability and turmoil in those places. So where are the key elections that you and your organization are watching in particular with respect to sustaining democracy?
Yeah, you're very right. We talked about 2024 as being the year of elections, but this year is not going to fall too far behind, right? And at least 15 of those 70 countries are experiencing concerning levels of instability. Just to start with Latin America, for example, right? We have elections in Bolivia that's facing renewed political polarization, and the ruling party itself is very fragmented right now. Ecuador and Honduras also having elections this year. They have the problem of criminal groups not only undermining voter security, but also their very choice at the polls since they are infiltrating politics. Venezuela is also holding elections for the National Assembly this time, but we just watched the inauguration of Maduro January 10th, despite his loss at the 2024 polls. So this confirms that the vote's not being respected there. As you mentioned, we have some elections that we're not sure yet if they're going to happen or not. In Mali, Burkina Faso, they're due, but the military juntas have postponed them. And of course, we are also keeping in mind other key post-conflict elections, not necessarily this year, but in Ukraine, for example, once the fight against Russian invaders is over, or in post-Assad Syria, when conditions allow. And what we'll be watching for is the extent to which these processes meet democratic standards, right? We hope to see proactive efforts to stabilize security, to rebuild infrastructure where needed, especially after conflict, to improve electoral legal frameworks, to enable fair and competitive processes, a free media environment, and citizen enfranchisement. So in other words, the opportunity for people to participate in a safe, well-informed, and meaningful way.
So a lot of what you just mentioned has to do with democratic norms, right? And I think one thing I've learned studying democracy as a law professor is how much our system relies on people adhering to democratic norms. How are you seeing that play out in other countries?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to start this conversation by saying that people around the world do still prefer democracy over all other forms of government. We have the data from the Pew Research Institute, from the World Value Survey corroborating this fact. But people are also increasingly dissatisfied with the way that democracy is working for them in their countries. So some political actors are leveraging this dissatisfaction with the status quo, running populist campaigns and getting elected. Once they get elected, they can erode democratic norms and mechanisms from within. So where this is happening, right? In El Salvador, we saw in 2019, the election was largely seen as credible. And Nayib Bukele won there, But then his reelection in 2024 was very controversial because originally the country did not even allow for reelections constitutionally. But he made changes to the judiciary during his first tenure that led to a reinterpretation of the document. We saw this also, you know, in Hungary with the 2010 elections being credible and then the process eroding in the later cycles. Venezuela, even if we go a bit farther, 1998, when Hugo Chavez was elected, the process was seen as one of the most modernized and the best ones in the world. And it has been eroding since then. So just to say that the breakdown of democratic norms is not necessarily happening because people reject these norms. And it also doesn't happen only during elections. So we can have very legitimate elections and see the breakdown unfold afterward. So we have to work to identify the signs of erosion early on and respond quickly.
Of course, one of the worst aspects of a breakdown of democratic norms is when it devolves into violence. And, you know, the U.S. is not immune from that, as we saw on January 6th, 2021. What are the keys to avoiding election-related violence in countries around the world?
Yeah, and I last year actually talked to a lot of election commissioners in OAS, the Organization of American States, event about this, because it's a hot topic. Everybody's interested because it's on the rise globally. Right. And across the countries where we work, we see a variety of perpetrators of violence, incentives, tactics. So the solutions might differ. We have, for example, we see some research showing that narrow margins of victory tend to lead to more violence, or executive elections tend to be more violent than legislative elections. Right. So there is nothing really that we can do about that. But there are some things that are under the control or influence of election authorities and the government. So one obvious factor is the quality of elections, right? Poorly organized elections tend to lead to more protests and violence, especially when there are unexpected delays in the announcement of results, for example, or instances of problems and mistakes that during polls that gain traction online. So honestly, what I learned from this years working on elections was that election officials are very rarely given the benefit of doubt. Malpractice is more often than not interpreted as deliberate fraud. So if you really want to avoid election violence, make sure your election is very well administered. And you also, of course, have to make sure that there are there is a fair system to address election complaints, right? Giving people a peaceful venue for seeking remedies and contesting results if they think it's needed.
Interesting. And of course, there's also the problem of misinformation, right? That goes part and parcel with this, increasing the legitimacy and people's trust in the election system. How do we fight election misinformation? And, you know, there's even a question, was it in the country of Georgia that there was so much misinformation that there was actually called the election into question, if I'm remembering that correctly? So what do we do about misinformation that really infects the election system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and especially after the annulment. I think you might be mentioning the Romanian presidential
election. Oh, yes,
Romanian,
that's right.
Yeah. So the authorities there said it was disinformation, also among other irregularities, right? The best analogy I could think of was of lead in the water. If I may ask you, Josh, how much lead do you want in your water?
Yeah, of course, none, right? everyone
right?
would say.
Yes, there is no safe amount of lead, right? But the EPA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, has, they have set a zero-level goal, but also an action level. And above this, above the 15 parts per billion, there are more strict measures that must be taken, even the total replacement of service lines. And it doesn't mean that below that nothing should be done. There are some measures to remove lead from the water. But I don't know if you see where I'm going with this, right? Most elections will have their version of lead in the water. It could be disinformation, vote buy-in, voter intimidation, other violations. And we should keep aiming for zero levels and taking measures to reduce them whenever they happen. But we also have to establish clear thresholds for when more dramatic measures are needed, including the annulment, right, of the election itself. Because setting these expectations early and clearly to all stakeholders will hopefully reduce the likelihood of people perceiving decisions as politically biased.
And Romania, an election that was annulled, kind of reached that level?
Well, yeah. So that's we still don't have a final answer, right? So the candidate Georgescu, he actually appealed before the European Union Court of Human Rights. It's something that it's a big challenge for all countries and the European Union itself more broadly, because the text is very basic that what they have about the authorities' right or duty to secure fair elections, right? So we don't know exactly if the threshold will be acceptable for the European Union court, but it's interesting. The Romanian court itself has already scheduled the elections for May, but we still have to see what the rules are.
Now, are you optimistic about democracy? I mean, you know, I call this show Democracy Optimist, and some people criticize me, but I think optimism is not, I think everything is great. It's that I've got hope for how things can be. For someone who studies elections all around the world, are you a democracy optimist?
I think we have to be optimistic. And if not that things are getting any easier or better, that we'll continue to adapt to address the problems we face in a better way. I think we were all very apprehensive about 2024, right? Some people even said that by the end of that year, we would know if democracy will survive or not. And it was not black and white. We saw a bit of everything last year. We saw many great things too. At least 38 elections resulted in a change in government. And this does not mean, of course, that the new rulers will be more democratic, but at least it's a sign that they have not tilted the playing field enough to prevent losses at the polls, right? We also saw some increases in checks and balances in some countries, in India, for example, where now the BJP will have to be more accountable to coalition partners. Africa had a record 5 opposition victories, so also showing how the opposition is strengthened and being able to collaborate and coordinate better. Some countries also have mitigated the impact of disinformation, like Taiwan, especially countering the Chinese attacks. So yeah, we are seeing some good signs as well.
Dr. Fernanda Barril is a deputy director for the International Foundation for Electoral Systems, or IFES. Fernanda, thank you so much for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
Thank you, Josh.
Josh, today's conversation has focused on a global perspective to elections. In November, you spent a week in Brazil giving talks about the U.S. election and learning about the Brazilian system. What did you learn?
Yeah, I had such a great experience in Brazil. The people there are amazingly generous and kind. Brazil and the U.S. have a lot of similarities. Their former president, Jair Bolsonaro, is often compared to President Trump in the way they approach democracy. We had January 6, 2021. They had a similar episode, January 8, 2023, when, after Bolsonaro lost re-election, a mob of his supporters attacked Brazil's federal government buildings in the capital, Brasilia. Bolsonaro claimed, without any evidence, that the election was mired in fraud. One big difference, however, is that Brazil's election court ruled that Bolsonaro cannot run for office again until at least 2030 as a punishment for using government resources to undermine Brazil's voting system. The U.S. Supreme Court, by contrast, found that Trump was immune from prosecution for any acts that were deemed official, and he went on to win the 2024 presidential election. In fact, many people I spoke with in Brazil said that barring Bolsonaro from running again in 2026 was vital to sustaining Brazilian democracy. But of course, we'll see as the years go on how much that continues, because Bolsonaro still is an important figure in Brazil's politics.
We also learned a lot about Brazil's voting system. It's quite different from what we have here in the U.S. What did you find out?
Here's one of the most fascinating things I learned in Brazil. Voters cast their ballots on an electronic machine that does not actually list the candidates for office. Instead, each candidate is given a number, and the voters must input the number on the voting machine for the candidate they prefer. The reason? logistics. Brazil has a proportional system where the parties receive seats in the legislature in proportion to the vote totals, and each party can put up the same number of candidates as there are seats available in each region. So in Sao Paulo, for example, there are 70 seats available, and there are multiple political parties. It would be impossible to list all of the candidates for every party. Instead, each polling place has a master list with the candidates and their designated numbers that voters can look at before voting. Voters can't bring in their cell phones with them to vote. They must leave them on a table at the polling place before going to the machine. So they have to memorize the number of the candidate that they prefer or write it down on a piece of paper to bring with them. But no one seemed to think this was strange. They all accepted it as a normal and routine process of voting. Brazil also has mandatory voting, though it's easy to provide an excuse for not voting. And they have virtually no absentee balloting. Again, few people there think any of this is odd or needs changing. It just goes to show that there are lots of ways to run an election system that can achieve democratic legitimacy.
What's one thing that we can do to support democracy?
I think it's important for people in the U.S. to consider election policies from other countries. Maybe they don't make sense for the U.S., but maybe they do. Take mandatory voting, for example. I'm often dismayed when we see voter turnout of around two-thirds of the electorate in the U.S., and yet people celebrate what they think is strong voter engagement. What about that other one-third that didn't vote? Last year on this show, we spoke with E.J. Dion about universal voting in the U.S. What can other countries teach us about this issue? So, to support democracy, especially in an off year in the U.S., I encourage listeners to think about an international perspective to election rules. IFES has a great resource on elections around the world, which you can find at electionguide.org.
That's University of Kentucky election law and voting rights research professor Josh Douglas. Thanks for joining us for Democracy Optimist, a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions and WEKU. Josh Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm your series producer, Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com, and podcast versions are available on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to get in touch? Our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.